guys. I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll hear quite a few other people part of the TechNet tonight. That includes John KC2WGB, Paul WS2N, and occasionally Hal K60PZ with the more brief answers. The very loose schedule we follow is that for the first hour, we take questions or comments from people who sign in because they do have a question or a comment. The TechNet's been around for 33 years, started in September of 1982. So by now, we don't need a long list of people signing in saying they're listening. We don't have to be proven. It doesn't have to be proven that people are listening. So we save time by not doing that. Any job? During the first hour, we answer general questions from people who do have ham radio related questions, or at least subjects of interest to ham radio operators. Ham radio operators really are, in many cases, the modern equivalent of a scientist. So quite often they're interested in astronomy and quite a few other things, other kinds of science. So we allow a fair amount of leeway there. Don't worry because you think you've got a question that's too simple or too far off the subject, so to speak. There's no such thing as a dumb question on the TechNet. We have a philosophy that the dumbest question is the one that is most deserving of an answer because it represents the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. So therefore, the dumb questions are almost welcomed as long as they're done with sincerity. Good job. The first hour or so, depending on how enthusiastic people are, sometimes that extends well beyond the first hour. There's no exact law saying that the first section of the TechNet has to be exactly 1 hour long. There are people in the past who worried about that, tried to make that happen, which is a misunderstanding what's going on. We go with the flow. There's enough enthusiasm, enough guys asking questions, and we go for 2 hours, so be it. The TechNet lasts for 4 hours. It starts at 8 and ends at 12 o'clock. So we believe this technical net represents a record-breaking bit of history in that it's essentially the longest-lasting net we know of, all under one leadership. The fact that it's been around for 33 years is one kind of length of a net. The fact that it's 4 hours every single Sunday means the total number of hours the net has lasted is probably close to a record. And because people make suggestions as to how it should be improved, and it's gotten to the particular form it's now in, sort of a peer relationship, so to speak. The second portion of the TechNet is with John, let me drop. John KCWGB, who maintains the mailbag. What John does is to, by way of internet, snail mail, verbal conversations, telephone, or whatever, he finds questions that people have where they're not able to get onto the net and ask us directly those questions because they don't have the right equipment or don't have the correct license yet that they're working on, so to speak. So he selects two, three, or four of those general interest questions from the mailbag. John also maintains a watchful eye on the chat room and on the echo link. So if we're too quick on the microphone and we don't wait for the four beeps, so that portions of the system get timed out and the person who's trying to get through an echo link cannot make it by way of John monitoring the echo link. We know about that and we correct that as soon as possible. At the John section of the TechNet, we then go over to Paul WS2N, who is our space expert. And he keeps track of what NASA and ESA and all the other space agencies on planet Earth, what are they doing? He keeps track of that a lot more than anybody else I know. So there's always interesting things, always new spacecraft being launched and new spacecraft going in orbit around various things, making measurements. And so he brings us up to speed on that. And quite often we get a lot of questions from people who want to know more about what's going on. Of all the mail that John and I get, quite a bit of it is about the compliments about the space report. There are people who really look forward to that section. Let me drop. One of the most frequent things that gets discussed on the TechNet is the subject of antennas. There's probably more misinformation on that subject than any other. The method by which it is taught in our schools leaves a lot to be desired. The way information is passed from person to person. Sometimes misinformation gets passed on. People hear it so many times that they believe it must be the truth because they've heard it so many times. The latest issue of QST Magazine, the June issue, has an article discussing antennas, which I have some strong disagreements with. In April, we'll get into the subject of discussing that. Where does the gain come from in a Yagi? Are each of the individual parasitic elements acting as individual elements that are gathering signal? And by some magic means, all the signals get added together. There's a degree of truth in that, but there's a much better way of understanding what the director string of the Yagi is doing. It's at least a philosophy I've developed over the years, and using that philosophy has allowed me to come up with some antenna designs that some people think are very successful. So although the philosophy may be in error, it works well enough to come up with some very good antenna designs. Let me drop. Okay, so I think that gives you a little bit of a rundown of what you're likely to hear on the TechNet tonight. And so now's the time for people to sign in because they do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name. You got to give me your name because I'm so darn forgetful on names. And then the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW, listening for check-in.
W2RIY, Joe, yes.
T2HUC, Steve, yes.
Okay, there's two guys who signed in just right. Name, call letters, and the word yes. So we got Joe and Steve so far. Who else would like to sign in because they do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters, your name, and that word yes right now. K2RIW listening. I guess we still have a lot of people coming back from the Dayton Hamvention. A buddy of mine who's going to be traveling for 11 hours of driving time, he's driving all the way back to Texas, called me up while he's en route. We had quite a discussion. So lots of people en route from the Dayton Hamvention. And on both Friday and Saturday, they had a moderate amount of rain and a lot of cold weather and a lot of blowing wind. Other than that, it was comfortable. But those guys are so enthusiastic. You go to an event like that. They started on Thursday evening, and they were flea marketing all through Friday, Saturday, and Sunday morning. And some of those people do it around the clock. They run around in the middle of the night with flashlights, buying and selling ham radio equipment. What goes on in the near field, the Near Fest, I think it is, up in New Hampshire, has a similar characteristic. People go around the clock. One last call. Anyone else to check in because they do have a question or a comment? Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW. Okay. So maybe we're going to have a little faster than usual for the first section. Although Joe is pretty deeply involved in this investigation of all that excess noise in his neighborhood on the South Shore of Long Island. It's kind of rare for somebody to use laboratory traceable test equipment by which he's measuring the sensitivity of his receiver while it's connected to a real antenna without disconnecting the antenna. There's ways of doing that. Joe is doing it, by the way, by an industry standard technique, and he's discovering numbers like 25 or 26 dB of lack of sensitivity on a real antenna because of excess noise in his neighborhood, possibly of a power line or other industrial source. And so the average person knows, he's got a gut feel that he's not getting the right sensitivity. Joe has actually caught and measured it with a good service monitor and other equipment. And so let's find out how that project is going. W2RIY, you need a bigger whip to control those noisy electrons, Joe. W2RIY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, W2RIY here. It's actually a two-part question, or two sub-questions, I guess, related to one category. I've heard like the term microvolts per meter. I'd like an exact definition, preferably how the FCC considers that definition, what they consider that, because it's hard finding a definition on, going out on the internet. That's number one. And number two, as far as making these noise measurements I've been making, and coming up with measurements as far as trying to measure, noise over a certain bandwidth, I wonder if I did something in a reverse fashion of when I have the availability of taking a signal generator mobile, of using that same coupling device on a mobile antenna connected to a mobile in a vehicle and actually moving the vehicle around or near a noisy point and see if I can get close enough to these points where I can actually make a measurement of apparent loss of sensitivity the closer I get to the noise-producing source. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to answer the second question first, Joe. When you're using that bug device, that's what people call it, it really is a T-connector where the third port has got an extremely loose capacitive coupling, maybe 1 picofarad. As such, it's got 20 or 30 dB of loss. As such, the third port presents essentially zero load on the straight-through signal. So therefore, when you insert that bugging device, as they call it, that bug-like device, that tap, when you insert it between your transmission line going to the antenna and that end, you insert it to the, between that and the receiver, in theory, you have not changed the sensitivity of the system at all by adding that device. Now, once you plug in a signal and you look for a particular amount of quieting, cyanide measurement, or whatever, by a signal that you inject, and because the tapping device has, let's say, 25 dB of loss, therefore you have to increase the signal strength from the signal generator by 25 dB in order to make the sensitivity measurement. But what I think you're asking is that when the signal generator is in that mobile, as long as the signal generator is putting out a calibrated amount of power, let me drop that. The fact that the signal generator and your receiver and the antenna are mobile, as opposed to all that equipment being at home in your shack, there should be no difference. By that I mean you're equally traceable to the Bureau. If you're able to drive your vehicle to a point where, by whatever means, you recognize the fact that the noise coming into your antenna is getting louder and louder, and it will correspond to your injection of a signal generator to try to make a noise quieting measurement or a cyanide measurement, you'll recognize that the signal generator has to be turned up louder and louder by the same number of dBs. They correlate. They continue to correlate. So if you want to be able to double check by way of a signal generator in your mobile and go through the extra effort of making that happen, probably involves getting a good 12-volt to 120-volt quasi-sine wave alternator in order to be able to run that signal generator. That's a perfectly valid thing to do. So I'm a little bit worried, a little bit confused as to why that second question you asked, Joe, what was your thinking as to why that might be an invalid measurement? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I didn't say I thought it was an invalid measurement. I just brought that up as far as, another way of attacking the problem. Instead of measuring the noise coming in through the antenna with a spectrum analyzer, instead of, various bandwidths, or, because essentially, from what I understand, the professor had said last week, this is measured across a 9 kilohertz bandwidth, and that's what the specification is, going back to part 15. It would probably make more sense to try to use a receiver, a receiving apparatus that had a similar bandwidth of what was being talked about, and try to measure against that to try to do a comparative relationship as far as distance from the noise source. And those, like you said, the closer I get, the more signal I have to put in to overcome the noise source. I guess it seemed like that is another valid way of doing it, as long as I maintain at least a 30-foot distance between that and the apparent noise source. But the first question is interesting also, because I find a lot of things related to that. They use that term, but I just wanted to get an exact idea of what that term is. I thought it was measuring something with an antenna 1 meter long, but I might be completely wrong on that. But I know they use it in broadcast, in the broadcast industry to make
that signal generator you're going to be injecting, and it's a mobile signal generator and a mobile receiver, and the nicest way to do it would be if the noise equivalent bandwidth of the receiver is close to the noise equivalent bandwidth of any of your test equipment, like if you're putting in a spectrum analyzer, for instance, and if 9 kilohertz is what Mike was telling us last week is a kind of an industry standard, I'm not quite sure that's the best possible standard, because I think a good ham radio FM receiver has closer to 15 kilohertz of bandwidth, plus or minus 5 or 7 kilohertz of FM deviation can be received without, flat topping and clipping and causing distortion. But if the real receiver has got 15 kilohertz of noise equivalent bandwidth of its IF strip, and if your test equipment is testing against a 9 kilohertz noise equivalent bandwidth, that's close enough. And the exact calibration between the two, it might be a 1.8 dB of offset, and that's easily to accommodate with the calculations. So that's not a problem, as long as it's in the right ballpark. If you're making a measurement with a receiver which is 200 kc wide, like FM wide probably is, I'll bet you FM wide and the R7000 might be close to the 250 kc of width. And if you then try to compare that to a 15 kilohertz bandwidth ham radio receiver, that difference is now stretching the laws of mathematics and conversion a little bit. You can run into some problems. The kinds of industrial noise that will affect a 200 kc bandwidth differently than a 9 kilohertz bandwidth. Let me drop. So as long as the bandwidth of the receiver, as long as the equipment is close, then you're in the right ballpark, and there's ways of making those measurements quite accurate. Now, the nicest way to describe a receiver sensitivity is to plug a receiver directly into a source of signal with the right kind of modulation, like a sine ad meter, and you crank up the number of microvolts or dBm. There's a one-to-one relationship between that. Minus 107 dBm is 1 microvolt, for instance, on a 50-ohm transmission line. Now, that's a very exact number, so to speak. And so to measure sensitivity in microvolts or dBm of the receiver itself has a lot of understanding among two-way radio people. Let me drop. The problem comes along now when you connect that receiver to a real antenna. The real antenna might have high gain or low gain or crazy antenna patterns and so on. As such, that if I was connecting it to an antenna with a known 10 dB of gain, and I now measure a signal over the air, and I'm trying to measure receiver sensitivity, I now have a certain number of dBm or microvolts of receiver sensitivity being modified by the 10 dB gain of the antenna. And now when I make a signal strength measurement of an over-the-air signal, I've got another thing I have to account for. So if you really knew the gain of the antenna, and if you really knew the insertion loss of the transmission line, and you compare that to the measurement you made of the receiver all by itself, its sensitivity, you can correlate all of those. But now in order to put that whole system together, to lump together antenna, transmission line, and receiver into one black box, you could now say that a high-gain antenna really has a big capture area, a low-gain antenna has got a small capture area. So the capture area of the antenna is now a factor in that overall measurement of that system. Let me drop. Now you have to use a different set of units. It's no longer dBm, it's no longer microvolts. It's now watts per square meter is the real basic information. That antenna, if you know the frequency of the antenna, the center frequency, and you know the gain, by way of the formula, area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi, that's effective area, by the way, by way of that, if you know the gain of the antenna, and you know the bandwidth, you know the wavelength, in other words, you know the frequency it's operating at, you can plug it into that formula, and you can calculate the number of square meters of effective area of that antenna. It's gathering signal across that area. Therefore, when it comes to evaluating the signal strength coming into your backyard, you no longer count the receiver no longer count the receiver signals. Here we go. You no longer count the signal strength in dBm. It's dBm per square meter. Watts per square meter. So now you've got to have an area relationship. That's called power, signal power density, I guess I would call it. So once you rate it in watts per square meter, you can now put everything all together. But there's another set of units that they've decided to use. Let me drop this. If you make believe that every antenna you're going to use as a standard has an effective capture area of 1 square meter, you make that leap of faith mathematically. In reality, if you're using a 10 gig antenna, the effective capture area might be 5 square centimeters. If you're using an 80 meter antenna, the effective capture area really is 1,000 square meters. The wavelength is a big factor. So, you now have to relate watts per square meter of each of those cases, whether it's a 10 gig antenna, which has really got a few square centimeters of area, or an 80 meter dipole, which has got 1,000 square meters of area. And so, to relate those in watts per square meter is one way to do it. You now can go to another system of units, microvolts per meter. And here life gets a little bit more complicated, because you're building a ladder. Step by step, you're figuring out sensitivity of the receiver, insertion loss of the transmission line, gain of the antenna, and the wavelength you're operating at. You put it all together. A signal of, I don't know the exact number, but there's some number of dBm per square meter, some number of watts per square meter, gives you 1 microvolt per meter. And how do they come up with that? The factor that makes this all come out right, whether you're operating at 10 gigs and you're putting out a certain number of watts with a certain gain antenna, or if you're operating at 80 meter and you put out the same number of watts with the same gain antenna, the one thing that's identical is both of them will create a signal strength of the same number of microvolts per meter. Let me drop. Of course, that doesn't make sense at first. Do you measure the microvolts per meter of the signal strength with a 1 meter antenna? Absolutely not. Good common sense, you would think you do that. You would think you put two probes of some kind of a very sensitive receiver. You put two probes out there. One's the positive probe, one's the negative probe, and you put the two probes exactly 1 meter apart, and when the signal is coming into town, you measure how many microvolts across those two probes. In theory, you could do that. In reality, you cannot. Those two probes have a certain length of wire to them. That length of wire has got an inductance. Those probes, the individual probes, have individual capture areas. If you tried to make that measurement, it wouldn't make sense. So the microvolts per meter is something you do not measure directly. You calculate it. If you know the gain of the antenna, you therefore know its area in square meters. If you know the signal strength of the signal that came into the antenna in dBm or watts or whatever units you like, you can now put the two together. And how do you put them together? Let me drop. You know that free space has an impedance of 377 ohms. You know that the signal coming down that coax cable has got some number of microvolts to it. If you now take the formula as power equals E squared over R, you take the power in microvolts, square it, divide it by 377 ohms, impedance free space, and you come up with a number. You come up with a number of watts, or you can work it backwards. If you know the watts that you received, you can convert it backwards into microvolts across 377 ohms. That would give you that amount of power. What you're really doing, the 377 ohms and the E, you're squaring the E. There's two different ways of looking at why you're squaring the E. Number one is mathematically power is E squared of R. Another way of looking at it is that 1 square meter of effective area. Assuming now I had a flat board which has a whole bunch of carbon granules across it. The flat board is exactly 1 square meter in dimensions. Let me drop. Assuming that my carbon granules are perfectly absorptive at this frequency, so I've got exactly 1 square meter of area, my signal is coming into that area I've aimed the board directly at it. You know, the normal of the board is aimed directly at the source of signal. In theory, all the signal hitting that board is going to be absorbed and turned into heat. In theory, I could measure the heat of those carbon granules on that board, and I could make an exact measurement of how many watts per square meter hit that board. And then I could, mathematically, by the formula I just gave you, watts per square meter, I work it backwards into how many microvolts across 377 ohms would give me that exact amount of power or that amount of signal strength. So it's a step-by-step process trying to get around the problem of lumping together antenna, feed line, and receiver all into one black box and measuring its sensitivity to a particular signal. And it's no longer dBm, it's dBm per square meter, which happens to have an exact equivalent in microvolts per meter. You calculate the microvolts per meter. You make a measurement of how many watts comes into my standard gain antenna. Let me drop it. And you calculate those microvolts. You don't actually go and measure a microvolt of signal strength across a 1 meter of length. You do it indirectly by knowing area and signal strength and knowing the free space has got an impedance of 377 ohms. It's kind of crazy. We all think we can build a dipole of exactly 1 meter in length and measure the number of microvolts received on that dipole. If you happen to be at a wavelength where a half wave is exactly 1 meter, which would be a 2 meter wavelength, yes, you could do that. But most of the frequencies we operate at, if you had a dipole exactly 1 meter long, the dipole would not be resonant at your frequency. Therefore, the dipole would have very different amount of gain from a so-called proper dipole. So for a bunch of reasons, you can't make the measurement of microvolts per meter directly. You do it indirectly. I know the first time you hear this it's not easy to swallow at all, Joe. You're going to have to go over this a number of times before it makes sense. It took me a lot of years of being in the industry before I started to really get a warm feeling about this one. To be K2LYY, I wonder if that helps. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it also makes some sense. You got to even hear it a few times. Well, the antennas used on the vehicle are loaded antennas, base loaded antennas. So I believe they have negative gain instead of positive gain when compared to a full length quarter wave wave antenna on the vehicle. I think they have actually a little lossy compared to a quarter wave. So they're not really a gain antenna. That's something else I guess I have to factor in also. I just was trying to understand that particular terminology. Maybe that's why I can't find a definition of it, because it's a little more complex than just a single definition.
Hey, you just made a statement, Joe, that 95% of all the hams would agree with you. But I disagree. You've used good common sense. Remember the example I've used so often. A full half-wave dipole in 80 meters, 132 feet long. We know if it's in free space, it's got a gain of 2.14 dB over isotropic. Every full half-wave dipole has a gain of 2.14 dB over isotropic. 0 dB of gain over a dipole, 2.14 dB of gain, and an area of 8,500 square meters. If I now take that wire that was 132 feet long, and I shorten it down to 32 feet, I'm still feeding it in the center with a good balance, and I re-resonate it by base loading each half of the dipole with loading coils, by zigzagging the wire, by putting top hat capacitors on the end of it, by using a very broad range antenna tuner right at the antenna. By any of those means, I resonate that super small dipole. I will come back to almost the exact same gain. I never lose more than 5/10 of a dB of gain on an infinitesimal dipole at resonance. It'll be narrowband as all hell. It'll be a very sharp antenna, hard to tune. But if I'm using lossless, impedance-matching devices, resonating devices, the fact that it's base-loaded does not lose gain. As long as you've got a reasonable connection to the metal of the car is a reasonable counterpoise. I will admit, let me drop it. If you were operating a base-loaded 80-meter ground plane antenna on your automobile, where now the automobile as a counterpoise is much too small for 80 meters, and you mount that automobile in the Mojave Desert over some real low conductivity sand. And now you're pumping a hell of a lot of that counterpoise power into that sand and heating it up. That would be an inefficient antenna. It's going to have lower gain. When you're up at 28 megs and 150 megs using the counterpoise of your automobile, which is a damn good ground plane, the fact that your antenna is base loaded doesn't matter. As long as you fed it with low loss transmission line, as long as the base loading coil is not made out of carbon granules, as long as when you transmit into it, it doesn't get hot. The fact that you base loaded and therefore it's a shorter than full length antenna does not matter. It will give you full gain. That's the infinite. The fact that you've got a half dipole, which is called base loaded monopole, or a ground plane antenna, doesn't matter. The fact that it's too small in length doesn't matter. Within half a dB, you're going to get the exact same gain as long as you've done it with lossless components. Ain't that crazy, Joe? To B2RYY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Well, I guess what I have to do now is actually go make a measurement in the mobile with this antenna that I'm using on both particular frequency bands to come up with some data as far as compared to the normal receivers out of theory, how much more signal I've got to put in, and that would probably be a way of determining how strong the interfering signal is coming in. Back to you.
Yeah, you got it, Joe. You worried about your antenna being too short to be resonant and it's base loaded. Minor factor, as long as you've done it with low loss resonating materials. The biggest variable you've got to have on your automobile is that maybe that base loaded antenna is mounted in the rear left hand corner of the automobile on the bumper. And the measurements that have done in the past show that when you put an antenna not in the center of the roof of a metallic roof of an automobile, but you put it at one corner of the antenna, you do develop a brand new azimuthal pattern. And the signal tends to fire in the direction of maximum mass of automobile. So if you mounted that base-loaded antenna at the rear left-hand corner of the car, you would have a main lobe a little bit stronger toward the right front corner of the car. The signal going through the car to the mass center, you know what I mean? So you could find this out fairly fast by taking a signal from a long distance away, get yourself in the middle of a nice, flat, big parking lot, and drive in circles, and you'll see that antenna pattern. So, except for the fact that your antenna pattern on your automobile is going to give you a little bit more gain in one direction than another, which is a minor correction factor, but it's something you're going to consider. You're enough of a scientist. Other than that, you don't have a problem with the fact that it's base loaded there, Joe. Your circuit would be a little bit more ideal if that base loaded antenna was right in the center of the roof. And whether or not you want to go through all the effort of mounting it there for this test, that's up to you. So, I have the impression from what you said, Joe, that you're moving in the direction of giving you the ability to run your spectrum analyzer, your signal generators, and many of your other pieces of equipment that run on 110 volt 60 cycle AC sine waves. You're going to come up with a technique by which you can run them at least temporarily from your automobile. Is that true? To B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it is. I have an 800 watt inverter that runs off 12 volts that I've used in another vehicle in the past, and it definitely runs the my spectrum analyzer or service monitor with no problem. Give me 110 volts of voltage as a source for that. That's not a problem. It just takes a little time to actually put it in this particular vehicle. And the antennas, I'm using a Magman antennas right now because I don't have any hold control of the vehicle, but I'm making the measurements of the antennas all in the center of the roof.
Fantastic. The average guy will say, hey, a mag mount antenna, gee, that's something you clip on in a hurry. It's not making direct contact with the sheet metal, therefore it's going to have a lot more loss. Lots of people believe that. Don't believe it. The fact that you've got a thin piece of plastic underneath that magnet so it doesn't scratch the paint on the roof of your car doesn't matter. That small amount of series capacitance by way of that piece of Teflon around that magnet, it's just another series capacitor that's part of the resonant network of that base-loaded quarter wave or five-eighths wave, whip, whatever it is. That, in theory, can be an extremely high-performance antenna, even though it's a quick and dirty, cheap mag mount. Don't let that fool you. Lots and lots of people think that a mag mount is a really yucky antenna. they sometimes compare it to a rubber duck. Yeah, the helical wound printed circuit board inductor that's often in the side inside of that magnetic structure, if that was done with super skinny copper on the really yucky FR4 board, there could be a little bit of loss there. And whether or not that's got a significant amount of loss, you have the ability, let me drop it. You have the ability to measure the exact insertion loss of that helical piece of printed circuit board base loading inductor. Put a known number of watts into that antenna, like say for instance put 10 watts or 100 watts into it for a couple of minutes, and then with your thermal imaging the thermometer, measure how much temperature rise you're getting on that helical winding thing. You can either find out that, hey, it's insignificant, or you can actually quantify it. You put 10 watts into it, and 1.5 watts is lost in the helical winding. That's making, you know, a few tenths of a dB of loss in the possible gain of the antenna. So there's ways of even quantifying that. I wonder if you also worried about that. Lots of people think that a mag mount antenna is a yucky antenna. That can be an extremely high-performance thing. As long as you worry about these couple of fine details, that's traceable to the Bureau, in my opinion, Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW, and the deckman.
No, I haven't had to worry about that because the mag mounts are an NMO type of mount. So the cable actually goes inside the mag mount. There's no circuit board or anything else. It's just the cable going right into an NMO mount on the top of the mag mount. So I can interchange antennas on the same mount from one band to another.
Yeah, sometimes that thing that's got the whip on it that plugs into the NMO does have another tuned circuit in there. Inductor, a capacitor, or LC network, or whatever. Sometimes there's other things hidden in there, Joe. But put a known amount of power in that for a certain length of time. Turn off the RF and go over there and put your hand on that base mount. You'll find out right away, is it dissipating power? Is it acting as an insertion loss? The only way you can lose extra RF energy in a connector, a coax cable, or a base mount, the only thing you can do is either waste it because of very lousy shielding, which is just another way of radiating, that's not likely, or it can turn the RF energy into heat. And if by various means you find out that the heat is a very low amount, then you're not getting insertion loss. Very similar to what happens with an antenna tuner. There are people thinking an antenna tuner has got zillions of dB of loss. They don't. If it did, it would run hot. It'd be melting its components inside that box when you run 100 watts or 1,000 watts into it. And most of them run almost ice cold. So all these predictions of great big insertion loss in dBs of antenna tuners, in most cases, I don't believe it. Because I don't hear evidence of it running hot. You don't put your cup of coffee on top of it and it suddenly boils because you're transmitting a kilowatt into that antenna tuner. Good luck with that project, Joe. And looking forward to what you find next week. The next person was Steve, into Hotel Uncle Charlie. How are those electrons treating you today, Joe? Here we go, Steve, into HUC, K2LAW, and TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. I have a question tonight, which is more of, just want to know. It's not something I'm going to attempt. But I've been looking at a lot of schematics lately for amplifiers. And I'm noticing, pretty much all the tube amps, no matter what type of tube or how many tubes or the arrangement of the tubes, they all pretty much have the same back end as far as, the band tuning and then the plate and load capacitors, tuning capacitors, on the plate circuit. My question is there anything special about that circuit? Is it designed relative to the tubes at all, or could you say you just take a commercial automatic tuner so long as the components are rated for the voltage and drop it in place of that and everything would work hunky-dory? Again, this is just more of a curiosity question.
My first question is that your address is listed as Port St. Lucie, but I'm hearing you beautifully on the input at 975-375. I suspect you've got more than one abode and you're on Long Island tonight. Is that true, Steve?
If I'm showing up as Port St. Lucie, Port St. Lucie, I would think that perhaps you put in the wrong call, Dick. It's Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Uniform Charlie.
You're absolutely right. I broke down N2HUC. Sorry about that, Steve. And I should have realized that that person doesn't have the name of Steve. Okay, all's well. When it comes to tube amplifiers, running 100 watts or 500 watts or 1,000 watts, they've been around for a zillion years, starting in the 40s. Tubes like 6146s, 807s, and much more modern tubes. I can't even think of the model numbers, but you know the tubes I'm talking about. All those tubes have something in common, Steve, and that is, at the voltage you're putting on the plate and the current that the plate can produce of RF pulsing when you drive the grid or the cathode of that tube, in almost all cases, that plate circuit of that tube has an impedance somewhere in the vicinity of a 1, 2, 3, 4,000 ohm. So whether it's a medium or low power tube like 100 watts, a pair of 6146s running in parallel, or it's one of these great big bottles, the great big bottle runs at a higher voltage, at a higher current, and it still comes out to roughly the same impedance. So the actual plate tuning network, which in the early days used to be a Pi network, the C1 capacitor, we called it the tuning capacitor, the inductor, which has a tapping on it depending on which band you're on, and an output tuning capacitor, which we call the loading capacitor. That circuit has been around for so many years, it's an industry standard, so to speak. It's something that's got a lot of history. Let me drop it. And except for the fact that one end of that circuit, which is the plate cap of the tool, is feeding something like, let me pick a number, 2,000 ohms of impedance, and the other end is feeding your coax connector, a 50 ohm transmission line, other than the fact that it's 2,000 on one end and 50 on the other end, the schematic diagram of that versus a high power antenna tuner is identical. You just take that C1 capacitor, which used to go up to, let me pick a number, 100 picofarads, because it's matching something like 2,000 ohms, and you increase the size of that air variable capacitor so it can now go to 365 picofarads, so now it can match 50 ohms in versus 50 ohms out. Other than the fact you change the size of that capacitor, you give it some more range, so to speak. Other than that, a high power antenna tuner and the Pi matching network and a classic tube type transmitter have a strong similarity. Because we all like real compact transmitters, and we go for these so-called no-tune circuits, where the great big Pi tuning network has been eliminated, and now you've got some kind of a simple balancing transformer in there. Let me drop it. So the good news is the transmitter requires no tuning. The good news is the transmitter is a lot more compact. But now you're forced into creating a very well-controlled load on that transmitter, like no more than 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. Otherwise, it goes into the self-protect mode at either lower power output or thoroughly turns itself off. And now you need an antenna tuner after that. So the plate tuning network we used to have, we're putting it back again by way of the antenna tuner. So the philosophy, the theory of operation, the size of the inductors and capacitors, the current that's caused, the Q of resonance, strong similarity between the old-fashioned Pi network and a tube amplifier versus a modern-day high-power antenna tuner. Now, the one fly in the ointment here is that some of these antenna tuners try to be super compact, and so therefore, let me drop. The great big air-wound inductor with maybe a quarter-inch diameter silver-plated copper tubing, or maybe eighth-inch diameter silver-plated copper tubing, the great big air-wound inductor that used to be there is now being substituted in some cases with a ferrite-wound, much more compact thing. And that could be a little bit more lossy. The good news is you're making something smaller. The bad news is it, in some cases, can't tolerate the same amount of power without running into saturation problems and some extra heating problems of either the winding or the core itself. So you can take a very high-performance air-tuned inductor, squeeze it down to a nice small size by wrapping turns onto a ferrite inductor, a ferrite piece got a permeability a lot higher than air that allows you to make much less turns and a lot smaller size. The good news is it's smaller. The bad news is in many cases it's lossier. But if they've done a good enough design, choose a real good brand of iron material in that toroid, the thick enough windings on it, they can come close to the performance of that original large air-wound inductor. But that's the only real source of extra loss in modern-day compact antenna tuners as I see it. And maybe because of that embodiment, let me drop. Maybe some of the predictions I read about for people that have done an analysis where they make a prediction that the antenna tuner is going to have 1.75 dB of loss at this power level at this frequency. If it was the old-fashioned type air-wound coil, no way in hell would it have anywhere near that amount of loss. That would be hundreds of watts of heating at the kilowatt level, which didn't exist in the old days. That circuit ran almost ice cold. The only thing that made any heat in there was the tube. But the modern-day antenna tuners, because of their compact size and new engineering techniques, might have some more loss. And so, ARL's laboratory does an evaluation of various brands of antenna tuner, whether or not they really measure the insertion loss in a way that's accurate represents a bit of a problem. Let me drop. My antenna tuner might be able to tune for a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio. Well, there's a zillion different ways I can have a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio. It could be have 1/6 of 50 ohms, or 6 times 50 ohms, if the load is a pure resistor, or the load could be a pure 50 ohm resistor with some amount of capacitive reactance or inductive reactance that gives me 6-to-1 standing wave ratio. And each of those cases that I just described will have different amounts of current flowing through different comfortable. It's a lack of good education. It isn't rocket science. It's just the way we present it to our engineers and engineering technicians is that's lacking. And we falsely led people to believe that there's black magic in measuring phase angle. What were you, Ed? So where was it used and what do you know about it? And it sounds like you were really marveling at that thing. And I'm guessing this was in the 70s or 80s when this was occurring. K2TJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, this was in the 60s, believe it or not. I was in the service from 61 to 64. I was stationed in Germany in the Army. So this was ground equipment. This was a piece of ground equipment. Vehicle it went, or where it went, I don't know. The stuff came into the shop. They had someone that only worked on this piece of gear. They had people that only worked on teletype. They had people that worked on telephone. They had people that worked on the equipment that went into the tanks because it was a 7th Armored Cav. I worked on a totally different transmitter, which I drooled over. It had some, vacuum variables. They had vacuum variables and some really nice size inductors, and you had to manually tuned it. And being a ham, I drooled over that stuff too, over.
VO2Z.
Sounds like VO2Z. We'll get to you in a second. Jennings air variable capacitors in those days were very expensive. Vacuum variable capacitors, bellows inside with a vernier mechanism, and very high in Q, very high in performance. However, as long as you're willing to go a little bit larger in size of the spacing of the air, the plates, that you didn't arc over the plates, a air variable capacitor could have done that function. So an amateur radio equivalent of that, with almost no sacrifice in performance, just a little bit of extra size, could have been built. So you were using that in Germany on ground equipment, and in those days they built everything so big and bulky and built like a tank, if you know what I mean. It had to be ground-based. It probably was too heavy to fly. but they could have definitely made a lighter version using what we now know. VO2Z, question mark. I thought up with your full call letter, sir, and your name, and then your comment on all of the above. K2LAW TechNet, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. The name is the call is WO2Z, and the name is Ian, and I might be missing something because I'm surprised nobody's come in and made this comment, but there's still one company that still makes a full tube auto-tune amplifier, and that's Alpha. And the current model is the 9500, the Alpha 9500. I myself own a Alpha 87A, which is an older version of what is now the 9500, that if you go on the HF band and you key the microphone, and the one I have uses three CX800 tubes, but the 9500, I think, has the 8877 or the 3CX1500, you know, the same tube. But if you key the microphone, it measures the frequency, it automatically switches band, and does the tuning and loading for you in I'd say a couple of milliseconds. It auto-tunes to the frequency, and you're on the air.
Very fine, Ian. So that answers the general question that Steve asked us earlier. Is that a... that sounds like an attractive device that Alpha... Somebody came along and reset the machine. So we got almost all of your message. On top of that, your audio is extremely heavy, so that you're over-deviating and making square waves, and occasionally the peaks of your voice make the machine drop out a little bit. So you've got to back off on the audio. You've got to worry about the timing. You were giving us some darn good information. I thank you. But you might want to make those two corrections. One last question before I pick up HUC, and that is this Alpha 9500. If I fell in love with that and I wanted to buy one of those today, is it currently being manufactured? Roughly how many dollars? Whiskey Oscar 2 Zulu. A little less audio, please. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, sorry about that, Dick. And I actually have another radio I could have monitored, and I totally forgot about the timer. I think it's somewhere in the vicinity of about $6,000, but as I said, it's current production. It's their latest HF auto-tune amplifier, and it's definitely, if you go on the website, you'll see a good write-up. You can probably download the instruction manual and learn as much as you'd like to know about it, but somewhere in the vicinity of $6,000 to $7,000, the Alpha 9500.
Yeah, maybe I'm living in the dark ages, Ian. $6,000 strikes me as a little bit kind of pricey. It's beyond my threshold of expenses. But then again, at your and my resources today, it wouldn't hurt our lifestyle that much to once in a while spend $6,000 to get a really good, potent piece of equipment. That's tempting. Steve, what do you think about all of this? KD2HUC.
Well, Dick, first let me say that I went to a website which is RKR Designs, and they're selling the Alpha 9500, which is a beautiful piece of equipment, might I add, for $7,995. That's way too much. Let's let it drop.
It was also very heavy. Back to you, Steve. Back off a little bit on the audio.
Is better. The other thing is, you know, aside from the $8,000, the near $8,000 for the amp, I could definitely see that it would be a cheaper alternative, you know, to take an old school design with say an 813 or a 3500G tube and modify an inexpensive auto tuner and put it in front, because $8,000 is an awful lot of money.
KD2HUC,
back to net.
But for all we know, Steve, that rig is so rugged, and you could use it for so many years as long as you don't abuse the tube. And some of those tubes last a ridiculous amount of time. My favorite tube in the world is the 4CX250B external air-cooled ceramic tube, 250 watts per tube, and a pair of those makes a fairly nice kilowatt. And I've always been threatening to build an amplifier. The parallel stripline kilowatt amplifier is always tempted to build a 4-tube version of that, which would put out a very comfortable 1,500 watts peak envelope power. The nice thing about an amplifier with 1,500 watts peak envelope power, and it's got a little bit of reserve inside, the right voltage and big enough tubes that it can really put out 2,000 watts and you back it off a little bit. Then, when it's running 1,500 watts peak envelope power and not doing any flat topping, boy, does that audio have punch. Wow. Can that kind of audio with no flat topping get through a pileup, if you know what I mean? And people will hear you and they don't hear anybody else. So that's very tempting. $8,000. Whoa. Of all the rigs that we can buy today, Steve, you're a little more informed than I am. Do you know of any particular rig any pricier than $8,000 or $9,000? Is that sort of the top of the line of one single piece of equipment that you and I can buy? Is there anything else today I can buy that would exceed that price? KE2HUC, K2RIW, and TechNet?
Oh, yeah. I saw what I'm pretty sure was a Kenwood. It was either a Kenwood or an ICOM that was list pricing for $15,995.